Just an interesting story before we get to our main yarn of the night. The first shot by the British Empire in World War I was fired in Australia. Now, tomorrow, 5th of August, it'll be the 100th anniversary. It happened at Fort Nepean, which is at the entrance of Port Phillip Bay. There was a German ship called the SS Flutz that was leaving with the German consular staff on board, and it reportedly some contraband. Just thought that I would have a chat to Tim Fisher tonight, former Deputy Prime Minister, who's currently in the process of writing a biography of Sir John Monash, and believe it or not, there is a link there as well. Tim, good evening.
Hey, greetings, Tony.
Mate, can you just go, obviously, 100th anniversary of this, and it was extraordinary because it was the first Commonwealth action in the First World War.
It was midnight Berlin time, 11 p.m. London Big Ben time, and 9 a.m. Melbourne time on the 5th of August that the telegrams issued, war was declared from that point on. And literally, less than 4 hours into it, bang, that order to fire was given to fire on the false from Fort Nepean, and it was signaled across. They signaled to the ship to stop. It didn't stop. It was racing for the heads. And with that, one, indeed, a second shot was fired, and the pilot wrestled the captain, and it came to a halt. So it was a bit unlucky. It took extra coal, delayed a day to take extra coal to make a run to South America because it anticipated what was coming.
We should highlight the fact that Germany had a few interests in this general region. I mean, they were heavily involved in what is now Papua New Guinea today.
Exactly. The northeast quartile, if you like, of Papua New Guinea around Rabaul was a big radio station. It was a New Guinea colony, and that's why it's a bit wrong to say the war was a disconnect for Australia. It was the empires fighting over remnant empires up there in Europe. It had a very direct connection because in gaining that colony, ultimately, in the peace conference that followed World War I, Australia was a better place for World War II. Otherwise, Japan would have had a huge stepping stone for Rabaul at the start of World War II. But full marks to this first shot committee, which I'll be attending with Peter Whitelaw and others. I think many people will be, the State Governor of Victoria, because this is worldwide the first shot in anger in real operational terms. To Francis Train and to all the committee involved, you've got to salute them in making sure that this will resonate right around the world.
The Australian soldier involved was John Perdue, who was ordered to fire on the Fats, and obviously the shot did the trick, as they say.
Yes, it did. And subsequently, there was another one came through, as Major Bernie Gaynor points out, a few days later, and this time the boarding party got very smart. They knew what to look for. There was a German code book, and the German captain tried to get the code book overboard into the sea, and they were able to catch it just in time, and that contents of that German Merchant Navy naval code book was immediately sent through to the Admiralty in England, First Lord of the Admiralty at the time, Winston Spencer Churchill, and it played a part too in those opening months, dreadful opening months of the dreadful World War I. Monash himself, Melbourne, national capital was Melbourne, the action was in Melbourne, and he immediately became the chief censor. He immediately ceased writing to his cousins in Prussia, in Posen, and ordered everyone to break off writing in other than English. And we got serious about the war, and the enlistments started from day two.
Tim, there is a link between Fort Nepean and Sir John Monash.
Yes, indeed. He was a North Melbourne Battery trainee commander. He started private citizen soldier, worked his way right through to colonel, chief censor, then colonel, and for a period head of intelligence, revamped all the maps of Australia in the lead-up to the war, conducted two brilliant exercises in Lilydale and nearby, and Kitchener attended one, and General Ian Hamilton, who commanded in the Dardanelles, attended another, but he didn't learn more while he was out here in Australia. And Monash, of course, then was given the 4th Brigade and sailed himself on the 2nd AIF convoy, 22nd of December of this year. But It's a lot of stuff still falling out, including what Churchill said this year, 100 years ago, on his 40th birthday, to Lady Asquith, wife of the then Prime Minister of the UK. It is a glorious war. It is a delicious war. Pretty unfortunate choice of words, and he suddenly realised what he said, and he backed off and said, you know what I mean. I say, don't repeat that. I said the word delicious. You really do know what I mean.
He was the First Lord of the Admiralty at that point, wasn't he?
Went through three incarnations, started the war as that, did the honourable thing, resigned after the Dardanelles in Gallipoli, became a colonel in the trenches with a Scottish regiment, and did well, and really deliced his battalion, literally. He put a lot of effort into looking after his men, fought well, and then became Minister for War Munitions and worked out those machines that were going to make a difference, started building better tanks, and then John Monash, with his holistic approach, put that to use, and the Battle of Hamel, which Monash famously wrote should take 90 minutes, it took 93 minutes on the 4th of July 1918, paved the way for the Battle of Amiens, when Canada and Australia together captured more territory than had ever been captured in any 1 or 2 day period up until then. The tide turned, and we headed towards the Germans sued for armistice, 11th of 11th, 1918. But
Tim, as you say, a special commemoration tomorrow at lunchtime, and
at the PM.
Yeah, mate, thank you so much.
And Tony, I just add the full marks to the First Shot Committee, and on the 7th of August, full marks to the Canadian High Commission. They're conducting a Canadian-Australian dinner in salute of the Battle of Amiens. On Thursday night of this week as well in Canberra. So it's all happening. Good luck. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Tim Fischer there, former Deputy Prime Minister of Australia, National Party leader, of course. Referring to a moment in history, 100th anniversary coming up tomorrow, the 5th of August at 12:45 Eastern. It is the 100th anniversary, and it was the first shot fired in the First World War, and it happened in Melbourne. As they were trying to stop this German ship from leaving Port Phillip Bay, and they succeeded in doing that. They had the German consular staff on board, and a little contraband as well. So I just thought I'd bring you that update, because there are commemorations of that tomorrow. How often have you heard someone say, just be yourself? Maybe someone said it to you. It might have been when you were heading off for a job interview. The most important thing to remember, just be yourself. It's all very well, but you have to know who you are and have the confidence to back yourself. Easier said than done. Dr. Russ Harris is a psychotherapist and author of The Happiness Trap and The Reality Slap, and a nightlife regular, and joins us in our Melbourne studios tonight. Russ, good evening.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Yes, mate. Why do we hear that expression, oh, just be yourself, you'll be fine, so often?
Well, it's actually good advice. I mean, it's easy to say, it's very hard to do. There's something very special and fulfilling in being yourself and being true to yourself. And it's easy to lose that when we go out of our way to try to get approval from others or avoid disapproval from others and start trying to be something that we're not.
Can there be several different yous? I was talking to a colleague a little bit earlier tonight, and, you know, there are a lot of people who are, you know, are parents, you know, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, you know, employees, bosses. You know, it's, you know, you can be a myriad of people in one person.
Oh, yeah, look, absolutely. You know, we've all got multiple personality disorder. You're obviously going to be different with your elderly relatives than you are with the people you're working with in the workplace than you are with your kids. So there's kind of repertoires of behavior or patterns of behavior, ways of thinking and talking and acting that are different in different contexts and different circumstances, for sure. And yet, you know, there's a kind of certain authenticity or being real that can kind of go across all those different situations.
For a lot of people, they'd ask the question, you know, how do you know what your real self is? You know, it sometimes be hard to analyze exactly who you are.
Oh, yeah, look, I mean, that's a deep philosophical question that you could explore for years. Nonetheless, you know, we kind of get a sense. I mean, we've all said things like, I wasn't myself last night, or I'm not being the person that I want to be here, or, you know, I don't know who that was saying that or doing that. You know, we're kind of these behaviors come out of us that kind of shock us or surprise us because they're not really what we want to be about. At some level, we kind of can tune in to what we really want to be about. And I often on your show talk about values, you know, kind of underlying all the books that I write is this emphasis on clarifying your values, which are basically your heart's deepest desires for how you want to behave as a human being, how you want to treat yourself and others and the world around you, how you want to treat anyone or anything that you are interacting with. And as we start to get more in touch with our values and more attuned to our values, it's kind of easier for us to know when we're being real and true to ourselves.
I guess one of the main roles of a psychotherapist is to try and help people discover exactly what the real self is and how it relates to other aspects of your life. I guess that's what you guys do.
Yeah, I mean, a psychotherapist, but also in coaching. I mean, this kind of, you know, plays a role in workplaces and in leadership roles. You know, as a leader, what do you want to be about? It's kind of, but you know, I mean, I think it's also important for parents to help their kids discover who they want to be. One of the hard things, journeys for a kid as they grow into adulthood, is learning to be true to themselves rather than, you know, trying to please their parents or trying not to displease their parents. And that's a very hard kind of journey for most of us to go through. Very confusing as we move from teenager to adulthood.
And it's a very confusing time too, because sometimes you've got to almost make a decision on what your future career might be, and you know, your brain hasn't even finished developing at that point.
No, you're right, absolutely. Like on men, you know, the prefrontal lobes of your brain don't finish developing till you're 25, you know. I mean, my
some
first
would
career...
say 35, but that's another story.
Absolutely. I mean, my first career was in medicine, and I graduated from medical school as a junior doctor at the age of 23. And I look back now, you know, I'm 47 now, I look back and think, oh, that's crazy that I was making life or death decisions, you know, as a junior doctor at the age of 23 when my brain still hadn't finished developing. Crazy.
And I guess some personalities suit jobs better than others, you know. Some people, because, you know, sometimes just sheer luck, you know, have a very quick rise through the ranks and find themselves in managerial positions simply because they're good at, you know, whatever the company happens to do. But it doesn't always give you great leadership skills.
No, well, exactly. I mean, if I come back to my kind of personal journey, so I did medicine to please my parents. I'm the youngest of six children. All my older brothers and sisters were doctors and dentists. When I was born, the midwife held me up and said, "It's a medical student."
you know, like a lot.
And so I was basically kind of brainwashed into this degree in medicine, which I did really to please my parents. And for many years, I was kind of working as a doctor and not fulfilled. It was like, oh, I've got the job, I've got the status, I've got the title, and yet why am I not finding this work meaningful and fulfilling? And it really took me into my 30s before I finally changed careers and found a profession that spoke to me. You know, and so that kind of pattern is quite common. You know, we choose careers so young in life, and we're often pleasing our parents at some level or trying to get approval from others rather than really knowing what we want to be about.
Yeah. The bedside manner sometimes is just lacking in some doctors. My mum, when she was alive, had to deal with a surgeon, and he had absolutely zilch bedside manner. And, you know, they'd had a meeting about, you know, a very important medical matter, and she just looked at me and said, "I loathe him." It was just that the problem was, you know, there was just no interaction at all. It was, you know, he had almost zero, you know, communication skills, and, you know, literally just told you what you were going to do.
Yeah, well, exactly. You know, it's terrible. Hopefully, it's a little bit better in this state.
Oh, you know, that was a long time ago. Yeah. I mean, that was 30, 40 years ago. So, yeah. I mean, times have changed. But yeah. She found it radically difficult.
Yeah, no, for sure. I still think there's massive room for improvement there. When I went through med school 25 years ago, we got virtually no training on bedside manner. No one asked the question, you know, what kind of doctor do you want to be? What do you want to stand for when you treat your patients? What are the qualities that you want to embody in those relationships? You know, it's kind of, no one even talked about it as a relationship. It was, and this is an important question that we all need to ask ourselves, whatever role we're in, whether it's a work role or whether it's you as a radio host talking to your audience, or whether it's, you know, kind of a person talking to your next door neighbor. What do you want to be about as a human being in that relationship? What do you want to stand for? What are the qualities that you want to embody as you kind of interact with others?
What if you've spent your life seeking approval or avoiding disapproval? I mean, is it possible to learn how to be true to yourself under those circumstances?
Well, you know, look, this is always, we don't want to get perfectionistic about this. We all like approval and we all don't like being disapproved of by others. And so we're all kind of motivated by that to some extent. But it creates problems when it becomes extreme, when I'm so extremely motivated by getting the approval of others or avoiding their disapproval that I end up living my life to please other people or to fit in with the people around me or not tread on anybody's toes or rock the boat. And that often feeds over into a lot of anxiety and depression and, maybe even addiction. It's a very painful and difficult way to go through life, just constantly trying to please others.
What age do we start modifying what we do and say rather than just going straight ahead and whatever comes into our head?
Well, as toddlers, really, you know, as toddlers, we kind of learn that there are certain things that are going to get approval from our parents and adults around us, and certain
some of
things.
It's going to get a kick up the backside. Yeah.
Exactly, you know. As a young kid, you might say things that are, you know, completely outrageous for an adult to say, and you'll be told, don't say that. You know, it's okay to think it, but don't say it out aloud.
Where do you start if you've decided that you really want to be yourself and to, you know, develop perhaps some values that you haven't up to this point, you know, that you've sort of been a cork on the ocean prior to this, but you think, oh, well, hang on, let's just have a hard look at exactly what we're doing here.
Well, I think there's kind of, I mean, that's a big question, a very good question. Have we got several hours? One aspect of this is to spend some time really considering those questions, you know, about really what do I want to stand for in my relationships? And a very useful question to kind of imagine that you're in a plane and it crashes and everyone thinks you're dead and they have a funeral. And then you get found, and you get to watch the video of your funeral. And so what would you like to see people saying on that video? What would you like them to say about the sort of person you were, about how you treated them when they were going through a rough patch, about the kind of qualities you embodied as a human being, about what it was like interacting with you in whatever role that was? And that's a very useful question to kind of get yourself thinking about your values. And another part of this is learning to acknowledge your own experience honestly. So, like, for example, and talking to you on the radio right now, I do loads of public speaking and media stuff, and I always get anxious. And, you know, right now, you know, my hands are sweaty, my heart's racing a little bit, I'm quite tense in my muscles, and I just acknowledge it to myself. Okay, I'm feeling anxious. Anxiety is normal. It's what you expect to feel in a challenging situation.
Sure.
And so kind of being true to yourself in that way, if you're feeling sad or anxious or angry, just begin by acknowledging this is how I'm feeling and this is normal.
Mm. And they often say, you know, a little bit of an edge is a good thing, you know, rather than being totally relaxed and just sort of falling into it. You know, if you've got a little bit of, you know, butterflies in the stomach before the event, it probably improves your performance.
Oh, definitely. I mean, there's good research showing that if you're too relaxed, you have what psychologists call relaxed incompetence. I'm so laid back that I just do it really badly and I don't really care, you know. So it's kind of we've evolved to have a fight or flight response in challenging situations with an uncertain outcome. And, you know, your nervous system gets activated and prepared to fight or run away. And that manifests in different ways. We've got lots of different words for that. You might call it revved or amped or anxious or nervous or tense. Or it's a normal experience. In situations where you step outside your comfort zone or situations where you're challenged. So part of being true to yourself is to acknowledge that and recognize that that's normal. You know, one of the things that pushes my buttons is some of this positive affirmation stuff where you try to lie to yourself and you say things like, I am relaxed and I am happy and I am confident, in the idea that if you just repeat that stuff to yourself over and over again, it will somehow magically alter the way that you're feeling. That's not really being true to yourself.
Yeah. We were talking a little bit about phobias the other day, and, you know, everybody knows, people have been listening to the program for quite a while, I had a difficulty with birds fluttering around me, and, you know, if that happens, I can react, you know, immediately. I know that it doesn't do me any harm, but I know next time, you know, a bird flutters in front of me, it's like an episode of the Alfred Hitchcock movie.
Yeah, so it kind of, you know, acknowledge that, be open about that. It's fantastic that you're willing to talk about that in a public forum so people can kind of see that, you know, this is the human condition. I think a lot of us, our culture, particularly Western cultures, encourage us to go around with this mask on, everything's fine, I'm happy, you know, now worries may, everything's great, you know, and of course, that's not real life.
And some of the things are totally irrational, and you understand that they're totally irrational, but it doesn't make any difference. It's next time it happens, it still happens. Yeah?
Yeah, I know, exactly. Look, if logic was a simple and easy way to change the way that you think and feel and behave, then we'd all be like brilliantly behaved human beings. You could just say to people, well, it's logical. Don't take drugs, don't take alcohol, don't eat junk food, just exercise. That's logical. You know, don't worry about this, don't worry about that. It's logical, but you know, your brain and your emotions are not that simplistically reprogrammed, and logic often will not saying always, but very often, it's not going to change the way that you feel and the way that you respond.
What are some of the questions you might ask yourself to clarify what your values are?
Another really good question to ask yourself is to imagine you're 80 years old. If any of your viewers are already 80, they can imagine they're 90 years old. And you're looking back today and try completing a couple of these sentences. One is, I spent too much time worrying about. Mm. What's the end of that sentence?
Yep.
Another is, I spent not enough time doing things such as.
Hmm. That's the point. Yeah, and if you answer those honestly, you're probably halfway there towards understanding it a little bit more.
Definitely, definitely.
How do you distinguish between values and goals?
So values are how you want to behave right here, right now, in this moment. And goals are what you want to get or achieve. So goals are in the future. You're always moving towards them, aiming to achieve them, aiming to complete them. So marriage. Suppose you want to get married. Some people do. That would be a goal. It's something that you aim towards, and then when you've completed it, you tick it off the list. Marriage. Tick marriage number two. Tick marriage number three. It's done. It's, okay. So it's kind of marriage. Yep. Is a goal. You can aim for it and complete it and achieve it. Values are how do you want to behave in your relationship with your partner. So do you want to be loving, kind, caring, honest, open, sensual, intimate? And notice you can achieve the goal of marriage and neglect all those values. Notice too that you can live those values even if you never achieve the goal of marriage. If your values are to be loving and kind and caring and honest and open, you can live those values towards yourself, towards your neighbor, towards your friend, towards your dog or your cat. You know, there's lots of ways to live the value of being loving. And so this is one of the things that's empowering about values, is you can live them right here, right now, in this moment, even if your goals are a long way off or impossible.
You tend to sometimes get into a repeat mode, and I'll have to be fairly vague with this story because the person may be listening. So someone who does marry for a second time and strangely marries the same person, almost. You know, it's not the same person, but it's the same person. Yeah. Does that happen a lot?
Oh, yes. Yes, it does. It does. And, you know, it's kind of the statistics for a second marriage are not good. I mean, and the statistics for a third marriage are even worse, and for a fourth marriage are abysmal, you know. So it's kind of, you want to learn your lesson fairly quickly. But even for a first marriage, it's almost 50% divorce rate. That's a separate topic, though. We can easily, all of us easily, fall back into old habits, right? It's not easy to break a habit, whether that's something as from smoking or eating or a particular food that we tend to binge on or overeat. And habits can be the sorts of relationships you get into, the sort of people you're attracted to. I've had numerous clients. It's a woman who knows that she's attracted to bad boys. And, she's kind of had relationship after relationship with bad boys that have treated her really in quite inconsiderate or mean or sometimes even violent ways, and still keeps going back to those kind of guys because she finds them sexually attractive and exciting and adventurous. And some of those women I've managed to kind of help, you know, start to kind of notice those urges and cravings for those kinds of folks in the same way that you might notice urges and cravings for a cigarette or for alcohol, and kind of not act on it and start to kind of move towards a different type of partner. But that's not easy. It requires a lot of self-awareness and to notice your patterns and be willing to make room for the difficult feelings and urges that show up when you try to change a deeply ingrained pattern.
It's really strange. I've got to be careful with this as well. But, you know, I have actually been in a room where a third person has called the second wife by the first wife's name three times and no one's blinked.
No.
Whoa. Oh, where are we going here? What do you think of the old expression, fake it till you make it?
Look, I have problems with that expression. I'm not saying all the time, but I think there's a danger in being fake. So, for example, you know, tonight I chose to kind of talk about the fact that I'm feeling anxious because I'm obviously wanting to send a message to viewers that it's okay to feel anxious and it's normal and so forth. Now, there are some situations where I wouldn't do that, but I wouldn't then go the opposite and try to fake being non-anxious, try to fake being relaxed. I would just kind of be true to myself. I would acknowledge silently to myself, I'm feeling anxious here.
Yeah.
And then I would just engage in what I'm doing. And, you know, sometimes that means I have sweaty hands. And
sure.
Sometimes that means I shake someone's hand and I see their face grimace a little bit when they get the sweat.
Yeah.
But
how do you stop yourself getting hooked up on the unhelpful thoughts? You know, sometimes if you get locked into it, it's really hard to get rid of.
Yeah, well, it's another thing I often talk about on your show is mindfulness, which is this this mental state in which you can sort of recognize your thoughts and let them come and go, a bit like letting cars drive past outside your house. And, you know, anyone who's interested, if you just Google mindfulness skills, you can learn. There's all sorts of very quick ways of learning how to unhook yourself from these thoughts. And unhook is the key word here. You can't magically stop them from showing up. We all have no shortage of negative, unhelpful thoughts. That's the way minds operate. And you can do positive thinking courses, and it's not going to stop your mind generating unhelpful negative thoughts. But what you can learn to do is recognize them, notice them. Oh, okay, here's my mind broadcasting some unhelpful stuff, and just kind of unhook yourself from it and let it fade away, a bit like a radio playing in the background.
Yeah.
If you've had that experience, you're doing something really engaging and important, and there's a radio playing in the background, you hardly even noticed it was playing, and then suddenly one of your favorite songs came on the radio and you were singing along, and then the music changed and the radio faded into the background again. You can kind of learn how to do that with your own thoughts.
So that tends to happen. You know, you have a relationship breakdown and you turn the radio on and every song is either your song or a song relating to breaking up. It's hard to do. It's it's hell out there in the real world.
It really is.
Interesting one. ASMS, we've just received, it says, "Hi, I've been teaching wonderful children, kinder to grade 12 for 30 years, teaching career pathways to grade 7 to 10 for 20 of those 30 years, and questioning why we teach career education to grade 7 to 10 for the last 10 years. We gave so much choice to students, offering so many options, that they learn a little about a lot, and not much depth in any of it. To me, this is an iceberg teaching. We often only address the tip and not the substance below." And she said, "We've really got to start teaching substance before these kids."
Look, I would so agree with that, you know, and certainly by the time kids are getting to their teenage years, I think it'd be really important to start exploring values with them and what they want to be about. And, you know, again, as you say, it's just the tip of the iceberg. But what is the big hurry about getting people into a career so quickly? You know, when we're so young and naive when we leave school.
Dr. Russ Harris is with us tonight. We're talking about being yourself, a psychotherapist, author of The Happiness Trap and Reality Slap. Just wondering whether you'd like to join us to perhaps talk about some situations that you've had. Do you feel at times that you are finding it difficult to be yourself in certain circumstances? Has anyone ever given you the advice of, you know, be yourself at an individual? And have you found it useful? Perhaps you haven't spoken out about something because you were afraid of what other people might think about you as a result of you being honest. If you'd like to talk about stuff related to that, I'd love to talk to you.
Lines are now open. Call 1-300-800-222.
We could be the talk of the town tonight. Carry home your shoes in the morning light. Or we could just stay here a while. Wrapped up.
Presented by Catherine Britt, Saturday Night Country Volume 4 is a collection of the most memorable songs played on ABC Local Radio's country music program. Available now from ABC Shops, Centres, Shop Online and Good Music Shops.
Across Australia, it's Nightlife with Tony Delroy. Nightlife.
Coming up to 10 minutes, the latest ABC News. Monday Night Football, the National Rugby League, to complete the round, it was Melbourne Storm 28 over West Tigers 6. My guest in studio tonight, the author of The Happiness Trap, Dr. Russ Harris, and let's talk to a few people about some of these issues. Norma, you're very much agreeing with what Russ has been saying. Norma? Hello? I've got a problem there. Kevin?
Hey.
Good evening. Yeah, you've got an issue that you want to raise.
Well, yeah, I mean, I suppose around that sort of mindfulness regarding my son at the moment is leaving Year 12 we're having a bit of discussion tonight about, you know, what his future plans are, and it's sort of a bit grey around that area. And, you know, I understand a lot about the theories that the doctor's been talking about, but even I struggle with how to come up with the inspiring words. You know, as I say, you know, just be yourself. Well, that's fine if you understand about the self, who you are. But like you rightfully said, we're still going through an immense phase of discovery at that age. So, and then I'm sort of struggling, I'm sort of harking back to my own experiences and thinking, yeah, you've got a struggle in front of you, mate. I'm trying to come up with the right words to get him through.
Yeah, Kevin, I've got to say, my dad had an honest talk to me, you know, just before he died, and he said, I was so, you know, peeved that my parents guided me into the career that I was pushed into. Oh. And he said, I was so unhappy for the first 15 or 20 years. And it was just that, you know, they wanted the best for me, but it wasn't necessarily what I wanted.
I think it's more, you want peace of mind as a parent to know, okay, well, at least I got you into something. You know, and I went through the, I hark back to the same experiences, thinking, yeah, well, yeah, thanks very much, but it wasn't exactly where I planned to go. I didn't know if I had much of a plan.
Russ?
I think what you just said would be a beautiful thing to say. You know, it would be a really good example of you being real, saying this is a real struggle and I real struggled with it, and right now I'm struggling to come up with the words to say and kind of make it all right for you, and it makes me anxious as a parent, and kind of, you know, be real about that. I mean, that would be kind of, you know, mind-blowing for a kid to hear, oh, gosh, you know, my parents haven't got all the answers and they don't know and life is difficult, and make sense of your children's experience because they are going to be struggling with this stuff.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, he knows for well I don't have all the answers. We've already had some discussions along those lines. But, yeah, you know,
Are you happy with the plan that he's got laid out for himself, or he doesn't have anything?
No, there's not much of a plan there at the moment, really. I'm sure I may be underneath it all he has and just keeping his cards close to the chest, which is fair enough. But on the outside of things, no, there's not much of a plan there. And, yeah, as I said, I'm naturally a bit concerned that as the time gets closer to his graduation, that there's nothing in front of him.
I guess part of this scheme these days seems to be, you know, a change of job every 2 or 3 years anyway, and, you know, almost a learning curve over 8 to 10 years of changing and trying to find something that you're really happy with. It's not the womb to tomb that we knew.
Well, actually, I think I'm probably the worst example of that. I've probably changed jobs 70 times in the last 10 years. I've lost count in pursuit of a career, you know, improvement, and some have worked out, some have haven't.
Yeah. Russ?
Yeah, well, again, it is a struggle, and it's perfectly natural as a parent you'd feel anxious and concerned about that. And, you know, again, part of being real is acknowledging that there aren't simple answers and quick fixes to these things, and this is part of the anxiety of being a parent and the anxiety of being a kid growing up.
Yeah. Kevin, thanks for the call. Linda, you used to be the girl that went out with the bad guys, but eventually you got round it.
Yeah, thanks. I just wanted to share my story that for pretty much all my 20s and most of my 30s, I found myself in those relationships that were fun and adventurous, and you know, you end up in all kinds of great situations and having fun, but at the end of the day, the relationships were just never going anywhere. And I guess after a while now, I've learnt that these relationships aren't really going to make me happy in the long run, and it's really been many years of counselling that's helped to get me through it. Something else that I discovered about myself was that I realised that I was often finding myself trapped in relationships with the wrong men, and I actually learnt part of it was because of my fear of being alone at night time, and yeah, and it's quite strange, but I ended up buying my own house and was in a few relationships that didn't go anywhere, and I stopped doing that. I made a conscious decision that I was going to end the relationships and just stay single for a while and give myself some space. And eventually I got a couple of dogs, and I was able to feel safer at night and able to sleep and didn't have the need to need somebody around at night time, and I was quite happy to be on my own in my house, and been single for 4 years now, and I've just learned so much about myself and given myself that space to really breathe and just have some distance from those kinds of guys. And yeah, so I just wanted to share my story.
Absolutely. Russ?
Yeah, it's a beautiful and inspiring story. Again, you obviously got real about where these relationships were going, and you've kind of explored yourself and learned about yourself. And, you know, it wasn't easy, right? It took time and effort, and there's not a quick fix to these things. They're kind of ongoing, right?
Yeah, and counselling really helped. I've been going to counselling for 5 years now, and for me, counselling is just a part of life. It's just a part of life maintenance for me. It's like, you know, having a massage once a month. Will I go and have counselling once a month?
Fair enough.
Sort of helps mental health, just to have an hour of just sort of talking about anything and everything.
And refocusing yourself at the time.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, good on you, Linda. Great news. Tom, you've got a quote that you feel is ultimately relevant tonight.
Absolutely. Good evening, Russ. Good evening, Tony. My quote is, "My fear is real. When I honor it, I do not need to be controlled by it." That's by Ann Wilson Schaff.
So it's basically acknowledging the issue and, you know, so therefore you're stronger by acknowledging it.
Absolutely, and you try to overcome it. Like Ross's feeling of anxiety coming on the radio here. I used to have a fear of public speaking, and people told me to be myself. Well, myself included comedy, and you know how I do that. So.
I love it. That's a great quote. Can you say it one more time?
Sure. My fear is real. When I honor it, I do not need to be controlled by it. Ann Wilson Schaff.
I like it.
S-C-H-E-F.
One of my favorite quotes is by Oscar Wilde. He said, "Be yourself, everyone else is already taken."
Gentlemen, for a great show.
Beautiful. Thanks, Tom. It's Tom from Delaware finishing the discussion tonight. Russ, thanks for being there, and we'll talk again soon.
Thanks a lot.
There he is, Dr. Russ Harris, a psychotherapist and author of The Happiness Trap and The Reality Slap. And he will return in a little while.